Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
We want to see calmer heads prevail, and we are directing all our diplomatic efforts to that end.
World leaders may be asking for restraint, but after being attacked by Iran, Israel isn't making promises. It's planning and has said it will hit back. The next move carries the risk of setting off a broader regional conflict, but some also see an opportunity to de-escalate. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Susan Bonner, and tonight I'm in Ottawa. It is Monday, April 15th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern, also on the podcast.
This is really an attack on a political opponent. That's all it is. So I'm very honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Donald Trump says he's proud to be the first American president to face a criminal trial. Jury selection has begun in Trump's New York hush money case. The biggest question may not be guilty or innocent, but how the trial affects Trump's bid for the White House. And here in Ottawa, preparations are getting ready for tomorrow's federal budget. Israel's war cabinet met today to discuss its response to Iran's attack. Several options were considered as world leaders urge Israel to avoid sparking an all-out regional war. In the unprecedented attack, Iran launched more than 300 missiles and drones at Israel. Most were shot down by Israel and a coalition of strategic partners. The CBC's Chris Brown is in Jerusalem for us tonight.
The aerial barrage Iran unleashed on Israel overnight Saturday could have caused tremendous damage. Instead, Iran telegraphed the attack in advance, giving the air defenses of Israel, the United States, and other countries time to prepare and then shoot down all but a few of the missiles and drones. In a desert Bedouin community in Israel's south, 7-year-old Amina Hassouna suffered a serious head injury from the falling shrapnel. A missile fragment came right through this wall, her father said. With the entire Middle East on edge over the decision Israel makes next, its military chief vowed his country will hit back. This launch of so many missiles, cruise missiles, and drones will be met with a response, said Herzi Halevi. All day across Europe and beyond, there have been calls for restraint, including from Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
We want to see calmer heads prevail, and we are directing all our diplomatic efforts to that end.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken echoed that.
We have been coordinating a diplomatic response to seek to prevent escalation.
But unlike in Gaza, where Israel was largely in control and was able to deflect some international criticism of its conduct, it may have to listen more now. It required military coordination with the U.S. and even Israel's Arab neighbors such as Jordan to counter the Iranian strikes. We've carried out the attack on Israel in the framework of deterrence, said Nasser Kanani from Iran's foreign ministry. He noted it was Israel that struck first by destroying Iran's consulate in Damascus, Syria. He warned if Israel responds, Iran will not hesitate to attack again.
Even if Israel does hit back, it's going to be something quite symbolic, I think, at this point.
Israeli professor and Iran specialist Menachem Merhavi says he believes whatever Israel does, it will be designed to avoid another military confrontation with Iran.
In a sense, they gave Israel at least a ladder to not attack in a severe way, to retaliate, which would force them in a way to retaliate and to kind of escalate things to a much more violent course.
The crisis with Iran has at least temporarily shifted the world's focus away from Gaza and Israel's war with Hamas, and now also the West Bank, where violence between Israeli settlers and Palestinians has erupted. Chris Brown, CBC News, Jerusalem.
The heightened tensions between Iran and Israel have forced some countries to choose their allegiances. Our senior international correspondent Margaret Evans joins us from London. Margaret, we know that both Jordan and Saudi Arabia played a role in mitigating Iran's attack. How significant or surprising is that?
Well, neither of those countries, Susan, have had good relations, as you know, with Iran in the past. Although last year, Saudi Arabia did restore or normalize relations with Iran. And in fact, I think some of the, you know, Washington's messaging to Tehran in this instance would be going through Riyadh. And of course, Jordan has had a peace agreement with Israel since 1994. But both countries have been extremely critical of Israel's actions in Gaza, the large number of Palestinians killed. And this isn't going to make that go away. I think their participation lies in geography, the direction the missiles were heading, but also in a desire not to see the conflict widen in the region, and of course their ties to the United States, because there are American bases in Saudi Arabia, there are U.S. soldiers in Jordan. You know, and Jordan in particular is interesting. It's in a really difficult spot because about half of the population in Jordan is of Palestinian origin, including Queen Rania. There's a lot of unease about Israel, and the leadership has been very careful to describe their participation in intercepting some of the Iranian missiles, to say this was not a defense of Israel, but it was a defense of Jordan's sovereignty.
And what about from inside Israel? What is the view of the support of those two countries?
Well, you know, we heard from Benny Gantz, the retired general. He's a member of Israel's war cabinet on Sunday, and he used his words very carefully. He talked about building a regional coalition and exacting a price from Iran at a time of its choosing when he was asked about potentially retaliation. And I think the participation of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, for some in Israel, I think it's a bit of wishful thinking, but I think it's also offered some hope, you know, in some quarters that a path that Israel was on before October 7th could be restored. It had normalized relations with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and it was also in the process of doing that with Saudi Arabia. And so I think there was like a hope that maybe that path could be restored. Whether that's realistic, you know, I think will depend entirely on what happens in Gaza when the war ends there, presuming it does. And also, you know, on the current nature of the Israeli government, because it's an extremely hardline government with anti-Arab religious nationalists in some of the key positions. And that, of course, will have an impact. Their main interest right now is to ensure that the escalation and escalation doesn't happen. So again, it also depends on whether or not Israel listens to the Americans when they are asking for restraint, and to take this as a win rather than to escalate further with another retaliation.
Margaret, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The CBC's Margaret Evans in London. Calls for Canada to declare Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps a terrorist entity are not new. But this weekend's attack is putting renewed pressure on the Liberal government. A conservative motion in the House of Commons is getting some additional support. Rafi Bujakanian has more.
I rise once again to speak about the urgent need to list the IRGC as a terrorist organization.
A new motion by Conservative MP Garnet Janis on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the primary branch of the Iranian armed forces.
Canadians have been anxiously following the news from the Middle East this weekend. The regime in Tehran launched a massive attack on the state of Israel.
The Canadian government has resisted calls in the past from many groups to label the IRGC as an entity that engages in terrorism. Today's motion is the second time in 6 years parliamentarians have demanded a vote on it. Deputy Conservative leader Melissa Lantzman.
This is a government that doesn't take terrorism seriously. This is a government that doesn't take national security seriously. That's what this motion calls on, and I hope they vote in favor of it.
The motion tabled by the Conservatives, as in 2018. They appear to once again have secured support from the other opposition parties, the NDP and their leader Jagmeet Singh.
The IRGC is a terrorist organization and should be thus named.
and the Bloc Québécois.
Il faut envoyer un message clair que notre position à nous.
We have to send a clear message in our position as a country, House Leader Alain Therrien says. Enough federal liberals voted for the motion 6 years ago for it to pass, but it was non-binding, and the government has not moved on it, even after increased pressure in 2020 when the Revolutionary Guard shot down a civilian plane, killing all 176 on board, including many passengers destined for Canada. This afternoon, at least one cabinet member suggested it might be time to take a hard line. Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc.
All options are on the table, and I've asked the national security community to provide the government quickly with that advice.
Foreign Affairs Minister Mélanie Joly says her government has been taking action, imposing sanctions on some Iranians connected to the IRGC.
Under my purview, what we can do is quickly designate key individuals that are part of these activities that are criminal activities against Israelis and also against our interests.
But Joly also had a message for the Israeli government today, which has now renewed its request for Canada to list the IRGC as a terror entity following Iran's weekend attack.
We think that it is important that Israel be able to protect itself. It has done so over the weekend, and we are clearly pushing for de-escalation, and we need to make sure that the conflict doesn't extend to the region. So that is why I've been clear to my counterpart in Israel, please take the win.
As Saturday's attack continues to have repercussions around the world. Rafi Bujikanyan, CBC News, Ottawa.
Indiscriminate attacks that are killing, injuring and terrorizing civilians could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning about escalating fighting in Sudan's northern Darfur. Guterres says the leaders of the warring factions have resisted all efforts at mediation.
Aid convoys have been targeted. Humanitarian personnel and warehouses have been attacked. Women and girls are subject to rampant sexual violence. And meanwhile, the impact of the conflict is spilling across borders. Over 8 million people have fled their homes in search of safety, 1.8 million to neighboring countries.
At an international conference in Paris, world donors pledged nearly $3 billion in aid. Canada is contributing just over $130 million to that effort. Coming up on the podcast, the federal government has already announced tens of billions of dollars in spending. What's left to put in tomorrow's budget? We set the stage. And the first ever criminal trial of a former president gets underway in New York. Plus the dire state of the world's coral reefs and what it tells us about the state of our oceans. The federal budget will be tabled in the House of Commons tomorrow afternoon. And on Budget Eve, we usually hear a lot of speculation about what will be in it. Not this year. Instead, the suspense is about how to pay for all the Liberal government's pre-budget promises. As Karina Roman reports, that will be quite the balancing act.
Comfortable?
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland describes her new budget day shoes, a tradition for Canadian finance ministers most years at budget time. These are from Maguire Shoes, a small Canadian business started by two sisters of the millennial and Z generations.
We have one store in Montreal, one in Toronto, and we opened now 2 years ago in New York.
These women are exactly the generation of Canadians this year's budget will be aimed at, evidenced by the many pre-budget announcements on housing, childcare, pharmacare, and youth mental health, and highlighted by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today in a speech at the Canadian Chamber of Commerce.
Our country cannot succeed unless young people succeed. And more, our country cannot succeed unless young people can imagine themselves succeeding. And they just don't feel that right now.
Those pre-budget announcements total $38 billion in new spending and loan programs, not including the billions attached to the new defense policy, nor any new measures still to be revealed tomorrow. Freeland has promised the deficit will not increase, but she also said this.
We will not be raising taxes on the middle class.
Sources have told Radio Canada that the target instead is the wealthy. Whether that means corporations or individuals or both will be revealed tomorrow. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh knows who he'd like to see pay more.
Big corporations that are ripping off Canadians, big corporate grocery stores, oil and gas companies, the big telcos are all ripping Canadians off.
But economists warn of unintended consequences. Hiking corporate taxes or creating a wealth tax could hurt Canada internationally by dampening business investment that is already struggling. Pedro Antunes is the chief economist at the Conference Board of Canada. He is expecting some form of tax hike tomorrow. But
taxes should be more broad-based. We shouldn't be picking winners and losers here. We think that that's not the best tax policy.
The Bank of Canada will also be watching tomorrow, looking for sufficient fiscal restraint so it can start lowering interest rates, something Canadians desperately want and the Liberal government needs to try to stave off further dissent in the polls. Canadian business groups are also clamoring for a tangible strategy to grow a stalling economy.
A little bit of a heel, a smaller person maybe.
The black pumps Freeland chose today retail for $230. Some Canadians might see that not quite in step with the cost of living crisis they're experiencing. Karina Roman, CBC News, Ottawa.
The CBC Radio will have special coverage of the budget tomorrow from Ottawa, beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern. It will be hosted by me and Catherine Cullen, the CBC Radio's The House. Some Canadians are getting their carbon tax rebates today. For people in Saskatchewan, it might be their last. That's because of a dispute between the province and the federal government. Sam Sampson has details.
Tummy aches and nauseous. Yeah, I can't get out of bed.
Regina mom Leah Key just found out she's pregnant. She's working through some first trimester symptoms and the realization she will soon have five children, five mouths to feed.
I do have a child that's constantly growing and eating.
Key says the extra $255 she got from the carbon tax rebate is a huge help.
Groceries, baby items, diapers.
But it could be the last time the rebate is that high.
We want the federal government to remove the carbon tax on everything for everyone.
Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe refuses to remit the carbon tax on home heating to the federal government, an illegal move. He says it's because Prime Minister Justin Trudeau removed the tax on home heating oil. That decision mostly affects people in eastern Canada, where heating oil is more common. Moe says that carve-out is unfair, since most people in Saskatchewan use gas to heat their homes. While other premiers have tagged on to this fight against the carbon tax, Moe is the only one who's refused to remit, meaning residents in Saskatchewan are the only Canadians who could have their rebates changed. Neither the federal justice nor environmental ministers have definitively said what penalties they might impose on Moe's government or with the rebate checks Canadians get every quarter. This month's rebates are being delivered normally in Saskatchewan. It's the next rebate that's a big question mark. Warren Mabee is the director of the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. He says no matter what happens, this political fight only confuses Canadians who already have a hard time measuring the carbon tax's impacts on their budgets.
You know, the big Achilles heel of the carbon tax as we pay it is that it's hard to relate how much goes out with how much comes back. And in a situation like you find yourself in Saskatchewan, where provincial government, federal government are disputing what should be collected and where certain things are not currently being collected, it becomes even harder to understand that.
Maybe doesn't know if Saskatchewan's rebates will be reduced or cut completely, but he guesses two things could happen either way. One, a meeting between provincial and federal leaders about the future of the carbon tax. That's something Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre has called for through a televised emergency meeting. And two, if the rebate does get cut, so could public support for the carbon tax. Seems a policy meant to help the planet is instead dividing Canadians. Sam Sampson, CBC News, Regina.
Jury selection is underway at the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president. And the process is an arduous one as lawyers carefully attempt to pick impartial jurors. Donald Trump is facing 34 felony charges in connection to a hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Katie Simpson has that story.
Stepping out of his Manhattan skyscraper, Donald Trump waved the news cameras to begin a journey that he and his legal team had aggressively tried to delay, if not put off altogether. Helicopters following his motorcade's every move from Trump Tower to the Lower Manhattan courthouse for the historic start of the People versus Donald J. Trump.
This is political persecution. This is an assault on America. And that's why I'm very proud to be here. This is an assault on our country.
While the former president sounded angry, he at times also appeared tired. According to reporters inside the courtroom, he seemed to doze off at several points as lawyers sorted out some final housekeeping issues before starting the jury selection process. Some 500 prospective jurors gathered at the court, required to answer an unusually long 42-question survey covering everything from whether they've ever attended a Trump rally or been a member of an anti-Trump advocacy group, to what news outlets they consume. More than 50 potential jurors were dismissed within a matter of minutes for saying they could not be impartial.
It's going to be a long, tedious process for the judge to make sure that you've got jurors who will actually just do what they're there to do: listen, decide, render a verdict.
Legal analyst Michael Zeldin says this case is all about falsified business records and whether a jury believes it amounts to an election campaign finance violation. Trump is facing 34 felony charges for allegedly improperly documenting hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels to keep their alleged affair secret in the final days of the 2016 election.
Because Trump knew that her story, in combination with Access Hollywood, would be very devastating to his election hopes.
At the time, Trump's treatment of women was under immense scrutiny after a video from the TV show Access Hollywood captured Trump bragging about grabbing and sexually assaulting women. Former federal prosecutor Joseph Morneau says there's nothing illegal about hush money payments. The question is whether the payments should have been documented as an election campaign expense.
That's the theory, that basically Donald Trump cheated the system and he hid this payment, which should have been declared. And presumably, if it was declared, it may have impacted the election itself.
Trump says he has done nothing wrong. He denies he ever had an affair with Stormy Daniels. And he continues to say, without evidence, the charges against him are politically motivated. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Washington.
One of the world's most valuable ecosystems is in distress. Today, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared a mass coral bleaching event. That means coral in every major ocean basin is turning white or even dying because of the ever-increasing heat. International climate correspondent Susan Ormiston has more on this phenomenon and the environmental impacts.
The world's coral is suffering from heat stress, sending an urgent message that ocean warmth is reaching a tipping point.
What this means is that within the last 365 days, coral reefs have bleached significantly and severely in all three ocean basins. So the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and the Atlantic Ocean.
As temperatures climb, coral loses color, stops reproducing for years, and sometimes dies. Derek Manzello, a coral biologist, says right now the most severe bleaching is off the South American coast in the Atlantic Ocean.
You know, at this point, it's pretty unequivocally due to ocean warming, which is mainly driven by greenhouse gas emissions and global climate change.
Global heat reached record highs in February and March. Scientists predict bleaching will migrate northwards into the Caribbean and off Florida. Within weeks, this could be the most severe global bleaching ever recorded.
The ability for coral reefs to recover from these mass bleaching events is really not likely, given that these events are happening almost year upon year at this point.
Nicholas Smith grew up in the Bahamas, now a biology professor at Concordia University in Montreal.
If we lose coral reefs, we're going to lose one of the most species diverse ecosystems on this planet, where 25% of no marine life live on these coral reefs.
Reefs are also formidable natural breakwaters for coastal communities. Last summer, in parts of the Florida Keys, temperatures rose so much some coral died almost immediately.
It's very challenging to watch what happened last summer and what's probably coming this summer.
We traveled with biologists implanting new coral on the reefs and in the lab raising more heat-resistant species. Jason Spadaro manages coral restoration at Moat Marine Labs in Florida.
corals have traits just like we do. And some of those traits mean that the corals are resilient to heat stress. The ones that survive and the ones that thrive are really the ones that we need to focus on.
Some of the bleach coral last summer, he says, have recovered.
We absolutely have hope. We have the data that very clearly show that this isn't the end of Florida's coral reef or coral reefs around the globe.
Even as coral has a bad fever. Susan Ormiston, CBC News, Toronto.
And finally tonight, an epic season finale of a critically acclaimed TV show has audiences in tears.
I'm absolutely gutted. I don't understand how that episode, why it made me so emotional. I don't understand it.
Watery-eyed fans posted their reactions to social media. A couple of alerts for you now. This story contains spoilers, and also the show is a cartoon about a family of talking dogs.
Louie, you'll have to sit in the front seat.
What?
The front seat? Really? Is that allowed?
Yep, it's allowed. Come on, get in.
This is the best day of all my life.
Bluey is an Australian series praised for its storytelling, realism, and wit. The season 3 finale is called The Sign. It weaves in Taoist philosophy about living in harmony with the universe. The title, a reference to the for sale sign threatening to uproot the family, but finally torn down in a moment of catharsis by Bluey's dad. His name is Bandit. Yes, it's still a kids' show. Episodes normally 7 minutes long, but the finale, 28 minutes. The ambition paid off with fans and critics and a lot of people at lunch recess describing it as a masterpiece. Thanks for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for April 15th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.